Accession number 20609, Reel 4.
Eddie Treacher, Reel 4.
Right. Okay. As I said before, we always moved from the position once we had a foot shot. But it was a craft. There's no doubt about it. It was a craft. And the Germans knew what they was doing as well, because they certainly had good snipers, I would think, because they certainly got a few kills. So,
how were snipers regarded by the men in the rest of the unit who weren't snipers?
They used to call us train killers. That's the sort of thing. They said, "Oh, here come the train killers." As a matter of fact, when Derek and I go to the Union Jack Club in Waterloo, they always say, here come the two train killers. So, you know, this is the sort of thing they do. And they call us the twins, and they call us the mafia. You never believe this, but they do.
because they didn't resent you as having...
No, they don't resent us. They feel quite proud of us. And especially Harry Wicks, he thinks we're wonderful. But we just did a job. That was our job, a sniper. So, something I never thought I'd ever do.
How long would you go out for at a time, then?
I think we'd go out for about 8 hours or more. We used to go out for 8 hours. We used to go through the lines of number 3 commando and come back later on, perhaps at 6 o'clock at night, 8 o'clock at night, something like that. You know, we used to make sure that we come away from that farm before a certain time, because we know that the Germans at dusk, they used to walk in. So.
And you always used to go out in pairs?
Always went in pairs. Always did go in pairs. We never went in singles. The only time we went singles is when you're with your own troop, when we come into Normandy and things like that, and when we were at Franceville La Plage. We weren't in pairs then, because we weren't in a brigade sniper section. Because once we got into a brigade sniper section, there was 8 snipers, one from each troop. So that we were brigade snipers, there's no doubt about that. We were picked because we were the best. Not bragging, but we were picked because we were the best.
And how far apart would you and Derek be from each other?
I should say not more than 20 yards apart. We was in seeing distance or speaking distance, so that we knew we could contact one another. We used that to try and contact one another. But I could always more or less see where he was, because I knew he was camouflaged, but I knew exactly where he was, so I could make him out. You know, sometimes once we're camouflaged, it's a bit of a job to find us.
Did you wear glasses in those days?
No, I never wore glasses, no. It's only since I was getting older I was wearing glasses.
So you were at this farm, what happened next?
Well, after that, I think we had, after 83 days, we went to a place called Menzil. That's where the 9th Parabrigade, 9th Parachute Regiment were. And we had to relieve them. They pulled out and we went in. So we moved away from Amphiville and went up to near a place called Menzil, or Mesnil, something like that. It might be Mesnil. But we went up there, and what we had to do is occupy the paras slit trenches in a field. They called it the brickworks. As a matter of fact, you can get statues there. I mean, in there, there's a little bird up there. And I got that from the brickworks. But anyway, what we did, we had to occupy their trenches. And what they used to do is, the Germans used to mortar it every so often. And when we heard the plop, plop, plop of the mortars, a whistle used to go. And everybody used to dive in their slit trenches to take cover. But we was never doing no fighting. What we were doing, we were going using listening posts on the Germans. We could hear the Germans where we were, and we used to use listening posts. And sometimes the Germans used to attack the listening posts. I mean, A Troop once again had one of their listening posts attacked, and they killed a couple of blokes there. You know, the Germans killed them and got away. But that's all we was doing. You know, watching and looking, and we weren't even allowed to fire at the Germans. We weren't even allowed to open up on the Germans because we didn't want them to know our position. They knew the position, but we didn't want them to know where we were, like, you know, and things like that. Also, we used to have our food brought down by different people, like from HQ. And one of my mates was bringing it down one day, and his name was McIntosh. And he brought the food down, he was dishing it out, and of course they got caught in the mortar fire. And he got hit pretty badly. He was coming back up on the stretcher, and he says to me, I was in my slit trench. He said, "Hello, Tom." I said, "What have you done, Jet Mac?" So he said to me, "I've just got up the backside," he said. He said, "And I'm going home to Blighty." I said, "Oh, yes." So he said, "Yeah, it's a Blighty one, Tom." I said, "Oh, good for you. I'll see you when we get home." So anyway, I was in the slit trench next morning, and a padre come round to me. He said, "Your name Tommy Treacher?" So I said, "Yes." So he said, "I've got some sad news for you." I said, "What's that?" And I thought it was something to do from home. So he says, "McIntosh died." I said, "He didn't." So he said, "Yes, he did." He said, "And could you make a cross of some sort? Like get cut the pieces of wood and put it together and make a cross for him." So I said, "Yeah, certainly, I'll do that." But now, when I go over to Normandy, I always go and visit my old mate's grave, McIntosh's grave, in Ranville Cemetery. I always go and see it, nor pay my respects to him. And that was that sort of thing. And I think we come to the breakout next. We were 83 down, 83 days in the lines, and we come to the breakout.
Can you tell me about that?
Yes, we got the orders to break out, you know, break our lines and move. So we moved into Pettyville, a place called Pettyville. We took Pettyville with three commando, and we went on, and we went chasing on. And then it was hard to catch the Germans, actually. And we got to a place called Pont-l'Évêque, if I can remember rightly. I've got it down there somewhere. And we had to do an infiltration at Pont-l'Évêque. What they call an infiltration. In other words, the Germans had a line, but we've got to get through their line without them knowing and attack them from the rear. And we was quite good at that. So we had to cross a small river first, and they laid all white tapes, and we had to follow this white tape. We followed this white tape, and we went between the German lines. We went up to the hill, up a hill. We had to take the high ground. We must take the high ground. We went up this hill. We got onto the top, and we come in behind the Germans. And they didn't know what day it was, because they was looking one way, we came in the other way. And they said, and in actual fact, they turned around and said, "We never knew you were coming in that way," because we completely took the place. That was no problems at all. And we had a few wounded. I mean, obviously, you're going to get wounded. And we then went on, and we went on, and we went on, until we came to a stop, and we got the orders to stop on September the 2nd. We stopped in a field of some sort, and they told us to wash, clean, have a shave, have, you know, because we was a bit mucky, have a clean up. And by September the 9th, I think they said, by September the 9th, we was on our way home. They said, the units can't do what they've got to do now. We want you home. So to refit. So from there, we went down to Arromanches, the dock, and the boat we was gonna get on. The young soldiers were getting off it, and they were saying, "What's it like, mate?" And we were saying, "It's horrible up there. You know what we are? We're old soldiers, like, you know." And they were saying, "Oh, great though." So anyway, we got on the boat. We come home to Portsmouth, and got to Portsmouth. And we come off the boats. Everybody was cheering and waving, like, you know, we'd all come back in the port. All the ships were tooting there, knowing that we'd just come back. And we went to Portsmouth, and when we got into they sent the boys band down to meet us. Not a marine band, the boys band down to meet us. So we marched into Portsmouth, and they said, "We're going to put you straight. You've had too much of a good thing. We've been out there fighting. You've had too much of a thing. We're going to straighten you up. We're going to smarten you a lot up." So we said, "Oh, all right." So we did. Okay, fair enough. They smartened us up. We went out and prayed. And the colonel in charge of Eastney Barracks said he was very proud to see the way we performed. So I was quite happy about that. Then we was preparing for the Far East. And we were preparing for the Far East. And we went to Bexhill. Bexhill-on-Sea. My landlady was Mrs. Small. She's a lovely lady. Mrs. Small, she was a lovely lady. And once again, what we did, we played football. I played water polo for the unit. I played football for the unit. I used to play for England. But you'll never believe it. We used to have England, Ireland, Scotland and Wales teams. An international we used to have, and we used to play football good. And I used to play water polo for the unit, and it was a big fight. The colonel wanted to play me to play water polo, and my sergeant major wanted me to play football, but of course the colonel won, so I had to go and play water polo. But we was being refitted for the Far East, definitely refitted for the Far East. So anyway, it came to the fact that the Ardennes Bulge came along. Oh, 1 minute. We got a leave on Christmas. We got a leave from Bexhill on Christmas time. And we went home. And we were lucky because most Christmases we got home. And we went on leave. And lo and behold, our adjutant had gone to a war office, and they were saying that we were not going to the Far East after all, and we've been equipped out to go to the Far East. So we're not going because the Ardennes Bulge had happened, where the Americans, the Germans, had got through the American lines, and us, the number one, was now number one commando brigade, not SS, because somebody didn't like the SS. But anyway, we was become number one commando brigade, and we were going back with the airborne to try and stem the rot in Holland and things like that. So anyway, went on leave, and when we came back on leave, within a few days, got ourselves ready on the trains. And away we went, and we got a boat over to Ostend, into Belgium. And we was in a Belgian barracks, but it had been occupied by the Germans. But that was okay. And then we got taken up to Holland. I think I went to Aston, a place called Aston in Holland. Yes. Yeah, I went to Aston, and we was there for a little while. And then we moved up to Venray, Venlo, up to those places. And we went in some Dutch families' houses, and they looked after us for a little while. Then we moved up to the Rhine, a place called Helmet. I think I've got the name of it there. Helmet on the Rhine. And Helmond, that's where we moved up to, because that was near the Rhine. That was a couple of miles from the Rhine. And of course, we stayed there for a little while, ready to move across the Rhine for the big attack on the 23rd of January. So anyway, we got there and we stayed there for a few days. And from there, we got ourselves ready. And one night on the 23rd of January, we got the orders. We're going to move across the Rhine. They bombarded it. They bombed it. I think it was about 250 bombers come across and bombed it. We had the Mountain Regiment. They were backing us all the way. And they were shelling it. And the Buffaloes come up. The Buffalo, you know what a Buffalo is, do you? It's like a tank affair with nothing on the top, just wheels, and it goes across the water. So we all had to get on the Buffalo, and we had a correspondent on there, and he said, "Who are you?" And one of our blokes said, "We are B Troop, and we are the best. We are Butcher Troop." So that was that, like, we are Butcher Troop. So anyway, we got across the Rhine, and it was early morning. We got to, and they were still shelling it over there, but we got to a place called Wesel. And I went into Wesel. Derek went in with his troop. I went in with mine. And in Wesel, we come to a stop. We went across the railway station. We come to a stop. Everything was going on. There was bombing and shelling and, you know, machine guns and whatever. And we come to a stop, and the colonel said to John Day, our captain, he said, "John, go back to the wireless people," he said, "because we've run out of radio to do something." So anyway, John Day went back, and all of a sudden, I was standing there, and there was such a crash there was in front of us. Oh, the sparks flew everywhere. I fell back and hit a tree. I really hit this tree with my back, and I thought, "Oh God!" And my arm went dead. I thought, "Oh, what's happened here?" I lost my rifle, and the colonel got wounded. There were 600 others wounded. We'd been hit by a Panzerfaust. They say to me it was two Panzerfausts, but I only heard one, and it hit me. It hit me in the legs. I've got scars there now in my knees. I mean, down your knees now, look, across my knees, see them down there, that's all scars. And
it's on your right leg.
On my right leg, and I got hit all up the right side. I got hit in the chest, hit in the shoulder, and I still got shrapnel in my chest. And my arm was paralysed, completely paralysed, and I was in a terrible state, and I was really battered. So I was laying in a road. And later on in years, one of the Faulkner, he said to me, "You know, Tommy," he said, "when I walked by you, I thought you was dead." I said, "Well, I'm not." So anyway, I got sat over on they took me over and sat me down on the road, the edge of the road, with a few others. And Lucia come along, Derek Gabriel. "You all right, Tom?" I said, "No." I said, "I'm in a bad way." I said, "My arm's gone dead." I said, "You know, and I can't move, I can't walk." So he says to me, "All right," he said, if you have to go back to Blighty, I'll see you when I get back to Blighty." I said, "Okay, Del." Like, you know, on he went. And the first day he got hold of me, they took me into a barn affair. And they give me some tablets. It knocked me out completely. And when I see the doctor next day, he looked at me and he said to me, slightly wounded. So I said, oh, good, that's good. But I still couldn't move my arm and I was limping. So, and I had a big lump come up on my shoulder and my chest. And anyway, he says, walking wounded. So I said, okay, walking wounded. I could hardly walk, never mind about anything else. So they said, righto, we're going to take you to the Sick British General Hospital. So how I got to the ambulance, I don't know. They got me to the ambulance, took me to the Sick British General in Belgium. And when I was in Belgium, I was in this hospital, and a doctor come round and see me. And he says to me, like, you know, how do you feel? I said, not all that good, like, you're the medic. So he says to me, okay, let's have a look at you. And he looked at me and he says, he said, you've got a swelling there. He said, but I don't know what it is. He said, I wouldn't like to say what it is. He said, but is your arm? I said, I can't move my arm. I said, that is paralyzed. I just cannot move it. So they were giving me morphine to help me. And then they put me into another ward, a dangerously ill ward. You know, so I thought myself, oh, well, this is nice. There was three other blokes in there. And then the surgeon came in. He said, we cannot do anything for you. He said, so we'll have to send you home to Blighty to have the job done. So I said, all right. And the next couple of days, like, they put me in an ambulance, took me to the airfield, and flew me home to Warwickshire. I was in Warwickshire Hospital. And my wife come and see me in the hospital. She come up to Warwickshire. And I was laying there, but still nothing was being done. And still they were frightened to look at me and do something. So the nurse come round to me. She said, I've got to put this needle and take some blood out of your lump there, see what it is. And she put it in. And when she pulled it out, it burst out. The blood flew out. She said, oh God, you know, she put it back and covered it up. And she said, oh God, like, you know. So the doctor come around again, looked at me. He said, well, he said, we haven't got the facilities here, Mr. Tricia, to do the operation. Like, you know, he said, you'll need an operation. He said, we haven't got the facilities. So he said, we're going to send you to Birmingham Hospital, Queen Elizabeth, Birmingham. So I got to Birmingham, put me in a ward there. There was Americans in there and things like that. And the doctors come around and looked at me. They said, well, we'll have a surgeon come around and look at you, Mr. Treacher. I said, okay, fair enough. The surgeon come around and looked at me. He said, well, he said, you're a very ill man, Mr. Treacher. You are very, very ill. And he said, we are going to put you on a danger list. Oh, I thought, oh, Gino. So he said, I'm going to put you on a danger list. He said, but that's just as a measure. He said, but we've got to do this operation very quickly. And my wife come up as well. And I was very, very tired man. I was a very tired man. I lay back in bed and I wanted to go to sleep. And that's just how I felt. I felt tired. If I'd have gone to sleep, I'd have died. So I wanted to go to sleep. So anyway, my wife was at the side of my bed. And he came up and he said, we're going to operate on you tomorrow. So I said, okay, like, you know. So anyway, my wife said, well, we're going now, Ed. Because she called me Eddie, of course. She said, I'm going now. We'll be back tomorrow. I said, what do you want to come back tomorrow for? So she said, I've got to be here for your operation. So I said, no, you don't have to be. I said, it's okay. So I said, they'll do it all right. But she said, no, we've got to be there. But I hadn't been told. I was so ill that I could die any time. So they took me down to the operating theatre. And what they did, I've got a scar on my right shoulder. One across the neck and one down by the shoulder and across my chest. And this is what they did. They opened me up by the neck. I had an aneurysm of the subclavian artery. When they opened me up, they found I'd got a split in the artery and by my blood congealing, saved my life. It absolutely saved my life, the blood congealing. So what they did, they dissected the artery and put a piece in. So I've got a little loop there.
You mean a nice artificial piece?
Yes, I put a piece in. And I've got a loop in my body now. And I still couldn't move my arm. I was still paralysed. But they said, every time there was a Vince, the orderly, came up, he was saying to my wife, "He's over, okay. He's still got a 50-50 chance." That's what it was. "He's still got a 50-50 chance. And he'll make it, Lucy." He said, "He'll make it." So anyway, the next thing I knew, I was up in bed. And somebody was rattling me bed. And they were saying to me, wake up, creature. You've got visitors. And I thought, I woke up like, and the first thing I see was my wife. And I see her face, and she was in like a halo type of thing, a ring. And I said to her, "I'm alive." That's me. That's how I felt. I'm alive. You know, I wasn't thinking, and I collapsed again. But then they moved me across to another bed near the door, because they said they can get at me any time. And I woke up in the night. I said to the nurse, "Oh, I don't know, I feel like." She said, "You will do. You've got all that water bottles all around you to keep you warm." I said, "But I'm roasting." So she said, "I don't care what you say. You're not going to." So she said, "Would you want a drink?" And she brought me some Horlicks in. I couldn't feed myself because I was so... Because in actual fact, my arm was tucked up in that position. Like, you know, it was caked to me. And they come in the morning. And they come to see me. So they said to me, "Is there anything you wanted?" I said, "Yes." They said, "What do you want?" I said, "A jar of pickles." I loved pickles. That's something I love. I said, "Get me a jar of pickles." And they brought me up a jar of pickles. But then, of course, I went to... they said to me, like, I could get up. And I got up and I started to walk. I was washing my hands. And I burnt my hand. Because the simple reason is, I've got no feeling in it.
You scalded it.
Scalded it. Yeah, I scalded my hand, and the nurse went, "Potty," she did. She said, "What are you doing that?" I said, "I can't feel it. I can't feel the water." So anyway, they done it up for me. And that was the operation. And I was laying there for quite some time, as you well know. I couldn't move my arm. And then they decided, a chap came in, and he said to me, "Mr. Treacher," I said, "Yes." So he says to me, "Would you like to move nearer to home?" So I said, "Well, yes, please. What's your nearest hospital?" So I said, "North Middlesex, Tottenham, see?" I said, "North Middlesex." So he said, "Fine, we'll get you moved." I said, "All right." I thought, "Well, that's nice." About an hour later, he comes back and says to me, "Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Treacher, we can't move you to North Middlesex because you're in the Royal Marines, your Navy." I said, "What's the difference?" They said, "It doesn't make that difference." He said, "But you are in a Navy and you come under Navy." So what did they do to me? They sent me to Liverpool, further away from home. So I was in there, and we was in this room, and you know what the old nurses in there were like? They were Alexander nurses. And you come to your bed, and that even the wounded have to stand the side of their bed and make their bed and make sure of that. And I couldn't stand up, I couldn't do anything. But anyway, they accepted that. Went down to see the surgeon, and he said to me, "Right, oh, sit down there, Mr. Treacher." So I said, "Right," I sat down. He said to me, "Right, now then," he said, "you've got a paralysed arm now." He said, "It will never get better." He said, "You'll always have an arm that's hanging." So I said, "Oh." He said, "Now, my advice to you is to have it off to the shoulder." He said, "Have it off. It's no good to you. It'll never be any good." So I remember that the sister at Birmingham said to me, "Tommy, don't let anybody take your arm off because you will use that one day." And I thought of that. And he said, "What I'm going to do is send you on 14 days leave." He said, "Now, when you come back, I want you to make a decision." I said, "All right." I went on leave. Spoke to my wife about it. I said, "What do you reckon?" So she said to me, "If that sister said keep it, Ed, I'll keep it." He said, "Is it interfering?" She said, "Is it interfering?" I said, "No, I'm all right." So she said, "Okay, keep it. So, and I did. I kept my arm and it was hanging down my side. I used to put my hand in my pocket, you know, put it in my pocket so nobody would notice it. And oh, my arm was thin. Oh, it was, you'd never believe it. I couldn't move it. I was 100% disabled, right, you know. So after that, they sent me to Wrexham, which is a...